Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your telepathic interplay of music criticism and cultural awareness. I'm John Pareles. That was David Vareas with Seven Through the Divination Horn. This podcast is actually Jazzcast with Nate Chenin and Ben Ratliff. Welcome.
Thank you. Hello.
Nate, let's start with you. Your album of the year, your top jazz album on your top 10 list was a Cuban pianist named David Vareas. Tell us about it.
This is his first album on the ECM label. It's called Mboko. It's continuing this preoccupation he has with Afro-Cuban folklore and religious ritual and culture, and sort of translating it into a modern jazz framework. You know, he's very into blending. He's very into doing a lot of things with timbre as well as rhythm. And, you know, this is just one of those records that's very deep, very resonant. I just kept finding new, wonderful things about it the more I listened to it.
And he's got a lot of traditional drumming on it.
Yes. His partner in these investigations is Roman Diaz, who chants as well as plays percussion. On this album, he's playing the biancomeco, which is a traditional percussive expression for the abacua. You know, there's a previous record that David Vareas made called Continuum that was, I think, 2 years ago. It was on both of our lists, on Pi Recordings. This record is very much a companion to that one. But for me, it was bumped up just a little bit because I felt like it's been streamlined a bit. It's been metabolized a little bit. And he has two bass players on this record, Thomas Morgan and Robert Hurst. They're used very, very well, as is the young drummer Marcus Gilmore, who is, you know, kind of a magician. So it all just really gels for me on this album.
And Ben, your favorite jazz album of the year was by pianist George Cables?
Yeah, George Cables, a record called Icons and Influences. George Cables was somebody you would have been aware of if you were listening a lot to jazz in the 70s and 80s. And, you know, I guess he still is probably best known as a sideman for Art Blakey and Woody Shaw and Art Pepper for a long time. And he lived in L.A. for part of that time, too. So he wasn't, you know, sort of on the scene in New York always. But he's back, and he made a trio record this year that in one way is a very typical, you know, mainstream jazz trio record, but super fine. It turns out that he's a great trio pianist, you know, which is a different kind of concept than a lot of other bands in which there is a pianist in jazz. It's a record on the surface, you know, whose pieces are dedicated to musicians, including, say, Cedar Walton, who died recently, that he was close to, that he admired, and also older, earlier influences, Bill Evans and Duke Ellington and stuff like that. What really moved me about this record is that it connects to a kind of tradition in jazz that I think we can say is sort of fading, you know, and it connects to this element of tradition that used to be like absolutely strong and you know, really part of the whole continuum as a representative of that tradition. It's both sort of up and sad at the same time. Like Jason Moran made a record this year, which maybe we can talk about later, all about Fats Waller music, and it was like recontextualizing Fats Waller and everything. But the subtitle of the record was, I think, a joyful elegy.
Yeah.
And that's kind of like what this record is too, this George Cables mm-hmm. record. It's got joy, and at the same time, on some level, it feels very sad. And I feel like those are things that jazz is very mm-hmm. useful for, because we're not really getting it from pop music. We're not getting a whole lot of pure joy or, you know, real considered sadness.
That's worth mentioning, too, that this album, Icons and Influences, in some cases, these are actual elegies for
yeah.
people that he knew and worked with or just greatly admired.
Mm-hmm.
And so the sadness is not just sort of large contextual sadness.
It's actually personal.
Yeah, at times it feels really personal.
Right.
Does he emulate their styles?
Not particularly, no. He's got his own. He's a tidy but soulful player. It swings, it's graceful, it's not all over the place, it's quite compact. It's just, you know, gorgeous, but it's like, as a gesture, it's not huge, it's not grandiose. It's just a very elegant, beautiful record. And it's like, yeah, it's about the past and it's of the past to some degree, but the past stays with us. We have to understand that.
Well, especially in jazz.
Yeah, especially in jazz.
One of the other albums you both agreed on was by Mark Turner. Tell us about that one.
This is a quartet record that he made with a trumpeter named Avishai Cohen, Joe Martin on bass, and Marcus Gilmore, who we've already mentioned, on drums. One thing to know about it, I guess, is that it's the first album with Mark Turner's name on the spine, you know, as the leader, since I think 2001. It's fascinating because it's not as if this is a guy who has been off the scene or out of our minds. You know, he's been incredibly productive.
Or living in Europe or
right.
Whatever. He's the guy.
Yeah.
I mean, for a lot of people,
he's been at the center.
He's the most influential saxophone player, perhaps, of the last 15 years.
But he has in him this tendency to, you know, not necessarily want to be out front. And he, you know, the idea of like having his name in lights, you know, or on the front of the marquee in the club it's kind of like he'll take it or leave it. He just wants to play. He wants to, you know, be able to dig in. And so one thing that's interesting to me about this record, which is just, you know, it's kind of sneaky. I feel like the first time you hear it, it has a very sustained mood and you can kind of get lost in it and not realize how much is actually happening sometimes. But he's decided to take the idea of the tenor and trumpet frontline, this great post-bop convention, and say, okay, well, as a composer, what can I do with this that works for me? It's almost a puzzle. These songs don't necessarily end where they started. They don't go where you expect. But there's a real sort of slippery rapport that these two horn players have. But there's also a kind of pugnaciousness, which is appreciated. Just top to bottom, like really, really advanced and soulful and great.
So is it Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie or is it Don Cherry and Ornette Coleman?
It's, well, what would you say to that?
Well, it's a little more like Don Cherry and Ornette Coleman.
Yeah.
Except that they're a good pair, Mark Turner and Avishai Cohen. Avishai Cohen is a little more of a battler, and Mark Turner is more like slow and steady wins the race, you know? I mean, he rises gradually to like great power, whereas I think in Avishai Cohen, there's a little more kind of like just getting it out there right away.
Yeah.
But as you said, I mean, he wrote pieces for them to play together, and they're not glib. They're not standard. They're not normal. They're very beautiful. And then underlying it all is Marcus Gilmore. Wow.
Yeah.
Just wow. I mean, he's always really good.
We'd have to look back, but I feel like he's been on multiple albums on our top 10 lists for a few years now.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's Vijay Iyer, you know, he's one of my favorite musicians right now, you know, and he never disappoints.
So. It's one of those records where you can all of a sudden realize that you've been listening to the drummer alone for the last 2 minutes,
yeah.
You know, and just following what he does because it continually changes. And you often have that feeling of, how does he do it? How does he do that?
Yeah, because it feels so natural. It's cerebral without cerebriality.
It swings. Ben, you were talking about the past and jazz is rethinking its past. You were saying that's been a larger theme this year.
Yeah, and I think will be more so as the years go by. I think that, you know, as we get further away from that period of time that I was talking about where there is a real continuity, you know, from the beginnings of jazz through like, let's say Art Blakey's death, you know, that kind of time period. As we get further away from that, we're getting further away from the people who were part of the continuity. So we're faced with this conundrum of what is jazz? Why are we doing this? What's the value of it? What do we get out of it? You know, what's at the root of it? What should it sound like now? You know, jazz, well, it's going to be interested in its own past. It's just going to be. And I think that there's a clear space for musicians now to explore the past in all kinds of really creative ways, not just reenactments or tributes or trying to get inside the spirit of somebody's playing or somebody's recordings, but much bigger ideas about culture and meaning.
Well, you know, Jazz at Lincoln Center has been an organization officially since, I think, 1987, but it really kind of came into full dynamic glory in the late 90s, maybe, sometime around there, where it really became this huge force. And so if you're a jazz person, you've seen what jazz repertory looks like, you know, with those kinds of resources and that kind of preservationist agenda. We've seen what that looks like and what that feels like. And it's a force for good in the world. In a way, watching that happen and even maybe participating in it, if you're like a student who played in essentially Ellington bands in high school, you know, that then you've sort of done that. You've seen that it's being done out in the world. You're probably not going to do it better than them on those terms. So you can find your own ways of, you know, paying tribute. And you can pay tribute to Wynton Marsalis, speaking of Jazz Lincoln Center. You know, if you want to play his album Black Codes from the Underground and you want to just play a nightclub set and say, you know what, we're just going to play that album tonight, that's like 30 years old now, mm-hmm. just about. That's part of the tradition, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. And so there's so much more available. And who's to say that it's any less valid to play music from the 80s or music from the 90s even, and take that as your, you know, for the moment, okay, this is what we're going to focus on, you know. We just mentioned Mark Turner. Mm-hmm. I mean, music that Mark Turner made, you know, around the year 2000 is as much a part of the vocabulary of a young jazz musician at the New England Conservatory or the New School as Coltrane or Parker or, you know, Coleman Hawkins.
Sure.
There's times when people wring their hands about that. I think it's just the way that things go. And the smarter musicians find a way to go past that, you know.
And then there are these other kinds of ways of dealing with the past, like the Jason Moran record that we mentioned earlier.
What does he do to the Fats Waller?
Michelle Indigocello is all over that.
Michelle Indigocello plays bass on it and also sings on it. And he's got his core trio as part of it, but he's also got, like, you know, a horn section. He just explodes these songs. He does something that he's often done in the past, which is he fixates on a small bit, a small kernel.
Like a sampling DJ.
Of a melody, like a sampling DJ, and will have a band repeat that over and over and build something out of it. It's like he's trying to get the genetic material inside of it and explode it, yeah. You know? It's the spirit in which he does it,
yeah.
I think, makes a connection to Fats Waller. Because for anybody out there who's listening who has not spent any time listening to Fats Waller records, those records are a blast. Mm-hmm. And they contain something so vital, almost like essential, about American attitudes, humor. I mean, they're as important as any documents in American art. So, you know, how are you going to pay tribute to that? I don't know. Seems impossible. But if you do it in a way that Moran did, you're on the right track.
While you were speaking, I thought of a moment in jazz this year that we both witnessed, which was the Bad Plus playing Ornette Coleman's album Science Fiction.
Yeah.
And it was kind of a similar approach, you know, in that they're not trying to recreate, but they are addressing the material, you know, in a way that shows how deeply they've absorbed it.
Much, much closer to the original.
It's not as much of a remix as Jason's thing.
But David Varela's record deals with this idea to some degree, mm-hmm. too. Like, he's dealing with the past through, I don't know, explorations of an ancient culture. And this idea of exploring the past in creative ways also comes up in Miguel Zenon's new record called Identities Are Changeable, which I saw, I guess I saw in a premiere last year in New Jersey, but he did several more performances of it as a multimedia work with a film screen, you know, a documentary element that he created. And also he made an album which
the album includes the vocal, you know, he did oral history interviews with a number of New Yorkers, you know, talking about various aspects of their culture and identity as New Yorkers.
Right. And so, you know, for somebody whose music was already to some degree about cultural identity, so much of jazz is about cultural identity and mergers thereof and how cultures change and move and combine with other things. I don't know. This just seems to be part of the wave of the future. It speaks to right now. If Miguel Zenon had made a record like this 10 years ago, which I suppose he could have, people might have thought, oh, this is sort of brainy and academic. At this point, I don't think it is anymore.
Yeah. Well, the best jazz musicians working of this generation in their 30s and 40s are very much in dialogue with the tradition at the same time that they're interrogating so many aspects of their lives as artists, including the tradition itself. And I think, wow, what an exciting place for the culture, for jazz culture to be. We've seen the influence of someone like Jason Moran, someone like Steve Coleman, you know, and it can only lead to more stuff that's interesting, you know, both in concept and, you know, hopefully in execution.
That was Jason Moran with Lulu's Back in Town, Fats Waller tune. There was also another jazz interpretation of the past that got people going on both sides of the aisle this year, Kind of Blue.
Yes, the album was called Blue by a young band called Mostly Other People Do the Killing.
Well, young.
Youngish. early 30s, right? Late 20s, early 30s, I don't know. I don't think we've talked about this record.
No, I kept a stoic silence about it at the time.
All right, yeah, now you're on the spot.
I came out sort of in favor of the idea, which was, to a large extent, it was a response in some way to this famous Borges essay called Pierre Menard, author of The Quixote, which we won't get too far into here, but you know, the basic idea is that there's this fictional author who endeavors to rewrite large passages of Don Quixote, but not just copying the text, but essentially, you know, re-inhabiting the space that Cervantes inhabited and just managing to rewrite it word for word. And Borges in this essay makes this kind of, you know, purposefully heretical argument that the Menard Quixote is superior to the original because, you know, yada, yada, yada. There's all these reasons. It's a wonderful essay. It's kind of a cornerstone of postmodern literary theory. And the bassist in Mostly Other People, Mapa Elliott, included this essay as the liner notes to this album,
mm-hmm.
which is, I don't know if we've even said this yet, a note-for-note recreation of Miles Davis's 1959 album, Kind of Blue.
And not just note-for-note. But
the sound of the 30th Street Columbia Studio.
Exactly.
It's an attempt to sort of recreate the aura.
Even the solos, obviously.
Yeah.
Solos. It's inflection for inflection as well.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was not made with all of these guys in a room just playing one take. It was made pretty meticulously. You know, tracks were laid. It was made using, you know, contemporary production techniques. John Irabagon, the saxophonist, plays both the Cannonball Adderley and John Coltrane roles.
Quite well.
I think it's incredible. I think it's an incredible document. And, you know, it was sort of dispiriting to see how the jazz world responded to this record. Either, you know, some people just having a knee-jerk kind of, this is blasphemy or this is, you know, like appropriation. And others just saying like, well, you know, it doesn't really sound like the original, you know, and sort of
right.
getting out the magnifying glass. I think that it's an intellectually mischievous thing to do, but it also raises some questions about how exactly we interact with these totems of jazz culture and how, you know, what are the sacred cows? And, you know, there's a thing in the Borges that I found applicable, which was, you know, he talks about how, you know, the Quixote is this text that we can't even see anymore because it's been so enshrined in mm-hmm. celebration. And Kind of Blue is exactly that. You know, Kind of Blue is an album that, for someone like me at least, you know, among the first jazz albums I ever heard, one that I've returned to often. But, you know, it has acquired such an air of gravitas and untouchability. And you know what? It's why is it untouchable?
There are some people who say about Kind of Blue, I've heard it so many times, I can't hear it anymore. Like I can't hear it anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, people say that about right. like the Beatles too and things like that. I don't know. I mean, like I was in a bar the other day and I heard something from Kind of Blue and I completely locked into Cannonball Adderley. Mm-hmm. I was listening to it. Yeah. I was definitely listening to it because it's really good.
It's really good. Well, here's what I'm saying.
I just
want to clarify.
Are you sure you weren't listening to Blue?
yes, I am sure.
Why?
And I can tell you why. The drums. The rhythm
yes.
section.
Yes.
Look, I mean, if I'm going to criticize it on those grounds, on, you know, musically it doesn't cut it, you have to talk about the rhythm section.
You can pick it apart.
Yeah,
I mean, you can pick it apart multiple ways.
Not nearly as good.
My point is just that when sort of listening to Blue, it's hard not to listen with a kind of like assessing degree of difficulty. And
yeah, how hard was it to
yeah,
pull it off?
Yeah, and I found for me that it actually – and well, what I did was I have Kind of Blue on vinyl and I had Blue on CD and I put them both on, played all blues simultaneously. With my receiver, I just toggled between signals, between phonograph and CD, about every 5 seconds. And it was perfectly in sync. And I got to hear, you know, John Arabagon for a few seconds and then Cannonball Adderley for a few seconds. And I found that it actually sort of refocused my hearing of the original in a really useful and fun way.
I did that too. But I also listened to Blue by mostly other people do the killing alone, without the original, you know, going back and forth A-B. And I found that the experience of listening to it was like, you know, like those old reel-to-reel tapes that are so old where the magnetic information is coming off and as you play it under the head, all the stuff
the oxide's flaking
falls,
off.
Yeah, flakes off. I felt like the act of playing this record, the musical meaning of it just left, flew away, flew into the, like it was gone. The moment you first get the album in your hands and you are informed about what this album is and what it's trying to do, that is when it's at its most complete. when you put it in the disc player and listen to it, the meaning of it drains away. And I found that it's a great idea and it's a sweet and clever story to tell somebody. Hey, I heard this record. You know what it does? This is what it does. Telling the story is as good, maybe even better than actually hearing
possibly,
the record.
Possibly. I will say, though, that as a commentary on the state of jazz education and the nature of young jazz musicians' relationship to the historical record, it almost seems like the terminus of this like great grinding, you know, phenomenon. It's like, you know, transcriptions and veneration and all this stuff. I just kind of feel like they said, oh, that's what you want?
Yeah, I mean, but you know what? There is no terminus.
I will say this.
I'm a classicist, so I just believe you can always learn more from the past.
Well, I believe that too. But I have seen so many tributes to Kind of Blue, and I've sat through so many flaccid, uninspiring versions of songs from that album.
Played by great musicians too, yes.
And it's like, why is this? It's so weird.
Yeah.
It's like, no one should ever play this, I guess.
Yeah.
But then these guys come along and say, no, we actually will play it, but we're going to treat it like classical music.
I was into the perversity of the gesture all the way. I'm just saying, as a musical endeavor, no.
Well, I won't reach, I'm not going to reach for it.
Well, another blast in the past is a recently resurfaced John Coltrane recording.
Well, this was a recording of Coltrane playing live at Temple University in 1966. And it was a recording that a lot of people had in bootleg form in one way or another. It's been notable through the years because, you know, it was during the late period Coltrane in which his music was getting denser and wilder. But also at one point he puts down the horn and he starts beating on his chest and chanting or singing. At the time, for some people, this was the end of the line, where they sadly, with a feeling of defeat, got off the bus with, you know, the great Coltrane, the greatest blues player of his generation, et cetera, et cetera. He'd gone too far. Mm-hmm. And so it's really great to have this entire document. It's quite an amazing concert. Pharoah Sanders is doing things that just seem like illegal, you know? I mean, like, there is such intensity in this playing that you have every right to turn it off because it doesn't conform with what you feel is acceptably orderly music. You know, you might hear it as just a racket, but the intensity is amazing.
And it was another moment that was sort of divisive in the culture, or at least in the discourse, you know, because Coltrane is one of our most, you know, revered figures historically and still a major influence. You know, even some of his late music has been kind of, it's been absorbed into the mainstream to some extent. But this is like, this is really, you know, where you pull out the stops. This is like the hard stuff.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there were a few people who they sniffed at it. And then there were others who came back and you know, vigorously defended it. And I don't know, it was interesting to me that this could be such a sort of disputatious object, you know, almost 40 years later.
Well, the two people who talked about it and were maybe quoted the most were people who do not write about jazz as in their regular line. And that's Jeff Dyer, the essayist and novelist, and Richard Brody, who writes about film mostly for The New Yorker. And Jeff Dyer was of the opinion that this record is just, you know, sort of noisy and out of control and ultimately an irritant, especially when you think about how great Coltrane had been. And Richard Brody responded to that by saying, well, Jeff Dyer is a listener who does not try to listen as an artist. He said that Dyer doesn't enter into what he called imaginative sympathy with the artist. And it's funny because Brody writes as if this is a precious condition. This is something there's not enough of in the world, mm-hmm. people listening to jazz with imaginative sympathy. And I sort of feel like I don't know about that. Mm-hmm. I think that people who like jazz listen to it with endless amounts of imaginative sympathy, too much often for my taste.
Yeah.
And, you know, it is okay to say that this music is an irritant. To some people, it is. However, it seems to me to be of great value too.
Well, also, I mean, 50 years later, we've had a lot of irritating music. I mean, our ears are retrained by everything that came after the 60s.
Yeah. I do have one question for you, Ben. Just curious, as a Coltrane author, a Coltrane biographer, would anything be different? Would anything have been different had this album been released, let's say, 6 months after he died in 1967? Would it have changed anything about the conversation around Coltrane?
I just can't see how it would have. I mean, what's there, you know, Live at the Village Vanguard again or Live in Japan or whatever, is totally wild. And
yeah.
Amazingly free. And what we needed to know about Coltrane, for the most part, we already knew. No, I don't think that the picture would have changed that much. Do you?
I don't think so either, because, yeah, it's Live in Seattle and Live in Tokyo.
Seattle.
Is that? Yeah, I was just curious, you know, what is the specific sort of gravity of this one concert? Like, why does it feel like such a meteor hitting
us? Famous because of the chest beating.
Mm.
I think so. That's how I always knew it before it came out as a record.
Yeah. That and the walkouts, right? The account of people.
The anecdotal stuff, which is so hard to pin down, mm-hmm. by the way. There are many stories about, you know, audiences dividing during late Coltrane performances. And one of them was in Chicago. And there's a famous story about, you know, couple of minutes after Coltrane starts playing, there's a mass exodus. But it's so hard to know what happened. You know, I spoke to a lot of people who were at that concert at Soldier Field, conflicting accounts. Mm-hmm. Who knows? You know, it was the end of a long day of free music that nobody paid for. So by the time something really challenging came on, maybe they just wanted to go home. It's so hard to know.
Yeah.
We just heard a little bit of Naima from the 1966 John Coltrane concert. We lost a great musician this year, one of many, but Charlie Hayden, the bass player, whose recorded legacy continued. He's on three albums this year, two with Keith Jarrett and one with Jim Hall. Can we talk about that a little?
Charlie Hayden was a force in music, and when I began to think about the impact that he had as a musician, he's one of the few people who you can say really changed not only the role that his instrument played in jazz, but the way that ensemble playing functioned to some extent. You know, and I think he's begun to get some of the credit he deserves for what he did in Ornette Coleman's bands, and then in many other contexts after. But one thing that's interesting too is he continued to be such a vital presence, until close to the end. And so the first record that came out, I think it came out before he died, but it was close, was this duo record with Keith Jarrett called Last Dance. The title, I think, was intentional. And it's a companion to a record they released a couple years ago called Jasmine, recorded at the same time in Jarrett's home studio. And it's, you know, it's beautiful. It's as beautiful as you would expect. And then there was another one that was posthumous, although it wasn't intended to be posthumous. And this is a 1990 Montreal Jazz Festival recording of Hayden and Jim Hall, the guitarist. This was, for a while, a contender on my top 10 list. Mm-hmm. It was obviously a sentimental choice, but it's a beautiful record. It's
super good.
Yeah, and it's some of the best playing by both of these musicians. And both of them had a lot of great recorded playing. They find such a wonderful simpatico. They play standards. They play, you know, songs by each of them. It doesn't feel like just another guitar and bass jazz thing. Like, it has its own kind of energy. What did you think of this record?
Hayden and Jim Hall.
Yeah.
It's one of those records that just sucks you in immediately. It's really intimate. It creates its own world. In a way, it's the best of both players, the best of what they could do.
I think the phrase joyful elegy applies here too.
Sure, that's right. I mean, both as a condition in which you listen to it and in the music itself.
And I'll let you talk about the final. There was another record really recently that, you know, is another archival find.
Yeah, of which I just feel like there's going to be more and more. Mm-hmm. Like the future is the past. If I can say that in a way that doesn't sound depressing,
mm-hmm.
I want to.
Right.
Because I think that it's not about wearing clothes from 1955 anymore. It's not about replicating solos by Duke Pearson or what, you know, like, it's about realizing that there's always more that we can learn from the past.
Well, we should say what this record
like
is, too.
That's completely amazing as a present-day aesthetic experience. So this record is called Hamburg 73,
72.
Oh my God, I've forgotten.
We'll be corrected, I'm sure.
Recorded in the early 70s, and it was the trio of Keith Jarrett, Charlie Hayden, and Paul Motion, which would soon be turn into a bigger group with Dewey Redman.
But there's saxophone playing on this album.
There is saxophone playing on this record by Keith Jarrett, soprano saxophone playing, which, you know, like, there's some people out there who have like a weirdly strong interest in Keith Jarrett as a saxophonist, and some of this playing is pretty good. It's all over the place. Mm-hmm. It's not neatly contained, but it's really good. This was a group where that was into exploring, you know, individual freedom, and Keith Jarrett wasn't reining in the group a whole lot. He wrote for it specifically, but he wasn't reining it in. So they all like went off and did their amazing things in this recording.
And this was early in that trio's life, wasn't it? Like fairly early?
Well, not really, because they were recording like 66.
Yeah. Okay, never mind.
In a way, it was late.
Yeah.
In this trio's life. And Keith Jarrett is much more known now as the guy who runs this trio with Jack DeJohnette and
Gary Peacock.
And Gary Peacock. But a lot of people still don't know that there even was another trio.
Well, yeah, there's so much more material available of the quartet from that time than of the trio. And so this is one of those things that I think is going to be studied for a while.
So it's like, it's strong music. It's like heart music. It's like exorcism. It's, you know, it's full strength. Some of it can get to be slightly self-indulgent or a little too much or whatever, but not too much. It's pretty, it has a clear sense of what it's trying to do. Mm-hmm. You know, it's impressive for this year or any year.
Amen.
Let's listen to a little bit of a Charlie Hayden composition, Song for Che, from the Keith Jarrett Trio. Thanks for listening to the New York Times Popcast Jazzcast with Ben Ratliff, Nate Chenin. Check out our Spotify playlist and come back next week.